So, I apologize that I'm not Pastor James. Okay. So we're continuing in the study of Hebrews. Oh, boy. Okay, so we're continuing our study of Hebrews, and I know that if Pastor James were up here, he would ask you, what is the theme of the book of Hebrews? It's the superiority of Christ. And so first we find that he's superior to what? The angels. And he's superior to the angels in how many ways do we find out? Yes, but how many does the chapter we study particularly say? Two ways, right? There's two ways that he's superior to the angels. He's superior because he's pre-existent and above them, and he's also superior to them because he became incarnate and became as man. Alright? And then the next part we have, he's superior to what? Moses. Right. And that's kind of where we left off last week. Now, in between the two parts about the angels, we have a section there that isn't directly talking about the superiority of Christ, right? Chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Somebody read that for me. I'm going to let you guys do most of the reading tonight. So who will read for me chapters 2, verses 1 through 4? Okay. Okay, so how would you characterize this particular passage? What is the author of Hebrews saying here in this passage? The message is binding. What else? What's the character of this message? This is not instructive so much as what? A warning. You can call this a warning, all right? And so one of the things that you're going to find about the book of Hebrews is part of the author's style is going to have alternating thesis and paranesis. Now, I was going to try not to use this word tonight, but you know what? I can't. And so because you probably are not familiar with this word paranesis, I have printed out a wonderful definition from the internet, and I'm giving it to Wanda, and Wanda's going to read for us the definition of the word paranesis. Okay, so all paranesis means is exhortation. It comes from the Greek to advise, and it can take either the form of a warning or the form of encouragement. Both of those are advised. And so what you're going to find in the book of Hebrews is that it's going to be alternate things of what is called thesis and paranesis because that rhymes so well. But what it really is alternate exposition and encouragement. Or exposition and warning. And so what he's going to do is he's going to take as his thesis an Old Testament passage, and he's going to take that Old Testament passage and he's going to expound upon it and expand upon it and explain it to you, and then from that he is going to make an application. And that application is going to be the paranesis, that's going to be the encouragement part. So this part that we had between Christ being better than the angels because he was above them and created them, to Christ being better than the angels because he was incarnate, we have the first warning. And the first warning says, you got to pay close attention. You got to pay close attention because you cannot neglect this salvation, because if you do, what? What does it say there? Hebrews 2, 1 through 4. Because what? You will drift away. Okay? So I wasn't here the first couple of weeks, so I don't know exactly what James covered with you, but one of the things that we need to think about here is, who are the intended readers? Who are the intended recipients of the book of Hebrews? They're Christians. What else do we know about them? They're Jewish Christians. We know that. How do we know that? Okay, all right, so All right, so here's another question for you. When you're thinking about the scriptures and you're thinking about how they come down, do you think that these titles that we have in our Bible, like Hebrews and the Gospel of Mark, do you think those were in the original manuscripts? No, they weren't there. Okay? And so you've just got this manuscript that just kind of starts, and it doesn't have a title, and it doesn't say Hebrews. Okay? So who added Hebrews to that we have in the Bible? Well, it's because early on, the people recognized from the character of the book that the intended recipients were Jewish Christians, that they were people that were very familiar with the Hebrew. Now, how do they know that? Well, they make inferences. Okay. For example, if you look in the book of Luke, you can tell that Luke is writing not to Hebrews, because when he talks about something Jewish, he goes on and explains a little bit about it because he thinks, you know, you're not intimately familiar with this. So he's writing to Greek people. But in this book, in the Epistle to the Hebrews, he talks about stuff in the Old Testament that he has every expectation that his readership already knows, that they are intimately familiar with. And so from early on, from the early church fathers, everybody has believed that this book was written to Jewish Christians. Okay, now, what else can we infer about the readership from reading the book? And some of you should have already read the entire book all the way through. But just from the fact that we have this warning in chapter 2, and we're getting ready to study another warning tonight, what can you infer about the Jewish Christians, about the readers that the author of this is writing?
They're liars.
Right.
Being obedient
by the commandments. That is, yes, that's good. What else? Right. And if you may infer just a little bit more and maybe make even a little small leap, he's got a group here that he is afraid might turn away. He is afraid that these people that maybe they've expressed it. Some of the scholars believe that these Jewish Christians got kicked out of Rome by the Edict of Claudius in AD 49, and that, you know, all of the Jews got kicked out then, and so they're trying to find a community to associate with, and the Jewish people that are not Christians won't have them. You know, because by this time we've got a pretty big split between the regular Jews who have rejected Jesus at this time and the Jews who have become Christians. And so we've got a community here, and perhaps, and this is, we can't be absolutely certain about this, and I don't want to be dogmatic, but it kind of makes sense if you look at it that perhaps these people they can't find a community to associate with, and so they're thinking, you know, maybe we'll just chuck this Jesus thing and go back to the old way. At least we got friends, you know. At least we got, you know, we lost our homes. We're not in Rome anymore, and this is getting really tough to be able to hold on to this Jesus thing. And so maybe the thing that we need to do is, you know, is it really all that important that we hang on to the Jesus thing? Maybe the old Jewish religion, you know, of which this Jesus thing is supposedly a fulfillment, maybe we just don't need the new stuff. Maybe we ought to just go back to the way we were. And so this is probably, and we can't say this with dogmatic, emphatic surety, but this is a good guess at who the recipients are. And so when you go and you look at these areas of alternating thesis and paranesis, what you have is this guy is telling them, hey, look, you've got to hang on to Christ. You've got to hang on to Christ. You have to be concerned about the way you live your life. You cannot throw this away. You cannot neglect this greatest salvation. Because, and we'll get to this, in one of the toughest chapters in the whole Bible for those of us that believe in the preservation of the saints or the perseverance of the saints, whichever way you want to do it. One of the toughest chapters is going to be Hebrews 6. When you get to chapter 6, it's going to look like maybe it's possible for people to lose their salvation. That's one way that you can look at chapter 6. We don't believe that, and James is going to handle that chapter. But you got to look at the paranesis. And so the paranesis that we're going to study tonight is the same type of deal. Okay? And so we're going to begin in chapter 3 in verse 7, and we're going to go through chapter 3, verse 7 through the end of the chapter, if we can get that far. Now, we're going to divide that up. The first part that I'd like, and you guys be finding it here, because remember, I'm going to get volunteer readers who are going to read it out nice and loud. The first part that we read is chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. So who will read for us? Joshua. Read nice, big, and loud. I know you can do it. You've got a big mouth.
Right now,
right now, read for us Hebrews 3, 7 through 11.
Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the days of trial, in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest.
Okay, now I don't know how your particular translation is, but in mine, those are all in small caps. That whole thing is in caps. Is it that way in your translation too? You know why that is, if it is? It's because it's an Old Testament quotation. Do you have a footnote in your Bible that says this is an Old Testament quotation? Psalm 95, that's correct. Okay, so I'm going to ask Joshua to read this again. I want the rest of you to turn to Psalm 95. Okay? And we're going to see, and here's what I particularly want you to listen for. I particularly want you to listen for significant differences, if this is an Old Testament quotation, for significant differences between what Joshua reads and what you see on the printed page in front of you. And when you spot it or when you hear it, raise your hand, because I want to see that you notice this difference. Okay, has everybody got Psalm 95 now? You ready to go? Okay, Joshua, read it again.
Again. Today, if you would hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath.
Okay, that they would not enter into the rest. I didn't, but that's okay. We've already passed the significant thing. Did you catch it? What's different? What's different? Come on. You know. Yeah. Meribah and Massa. In Psalm it says, Meribah and Massa. And this it says the rebellion and the testing. Right? Well, why is that? I mean, how can he be quoting the Old Testament and yet not quote the Old Testament? He's not allowed to change it, right? Okay, so I've asked your pastor to participate tonight by reading Psalm from the Septuagint. And we'll talk just a minute about what the Septuagint is. But he's going to read, and in the Septuagint, it's chapter 94 in Psalms, and he's going to read chapter 94, verses 7 through 11.
Come, let us worship and fall down before Him, and weep before the Lord that made us. For He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture, and the sheep of His hand. Today, if you will hear His voice, harden not your heart as in provocation, according to the day of irritation in the wilderness, where your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my work. 40 years was I grieved with this generation, and said, they do always error in their hearts, not know my way. So I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest.
Okay, so what do you gather from that? The thing that he read out of the Septuagint isn't the same thing that you have in your Psalm 95, right? It's very close, but it's not the same. Okay, so what we have is we have the author of Hebrews is actually quoting from the Septuagint. He's not quoting from what we call the Masoretic text. Okay, so what's the Septuagint, you say? Well, the Septuagint is the Greek version of the Old Testament that was completed sometime around 200 B.C. for Ptolemy II's library, classical library. Does anybody know who Ptolemy II is? All right. Okay. All right, yeah, Alexander the Great, when he got ready to die, he didn't leave his kingdom to his son. He left it to four generals. And one of those generals was Ptolemy I. Another one was Seleucus. And we know from Seleucus, that comes down to where we get Antiochus Epiphanes. You know who Antiochus Epiphanes is, right? He's the guy that slaughtered the pig on the altar in about 165 B.C. Oh, you got to know about that. The Maccabees. You heard of the Maccabees? Judas Maccabeus, fought against Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, that's the Seleucid line. Well, the Ptolemaic line, and I think the P is silent. It's spelled P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. So Ptolemy, I call it. It might be Ptolemy. But then I look like Joshua because I'd be spitting. But the Ptolemaic line, Ptolemy the second was a very educated guy, and what he wanted to do was he wanted to pull together a library of all the wisdom writings from all the different countries that were in his empire, in his quarter of the Alexander the Great's empire. And so he approached the Jews, and according to Josephus, they said, well, we'd be happy, but we won't let you translate it. We have to translate it for you, because he wanted it in Greek. And so they sent 72. Septuagint is it's abbreviated LXX, which is, of course, Roman numerals for 70. But really, it was 72 guys. It was six guys from each tribe, and they went on site to Ptolemy's, and they translated the entire Old Testament. And supposedly, they did it in 72 days. 72 guys in 72 days. And so that's why they call it the Septuagint, because that kind of has 70-ish in the name. And that was the Greek version of the Old Testament. And so during the time that, during the first century A.D., which is when the Epistle to Hebrews was written, and a lot of the other, most of the other New Testament books, we have a lot of quotes, and most of the quotes from the Old Testament you'll find come from the Septuagint, not from what we have, which is the Masoretic text. And some other time we'll talk about the Masoretic text. But they come from the Septuagint. Now, occasionally you'll find a quote from the Masoretic text, and it's particularly when the author wants to make a particular point. In this case, he's quoting from the Septuagint, and the point that he wants to make is he does not want to relate this to Massa and Meribah. He wants to relate it to something else. He wants to relate it to Kadesh Barnea. He wants to relate it to after the spies went out and they came back. That is the number's 14. So let's just look at the passage that talks about Massa and Meribah, since it's there, Exodus 17, 1-7. I'm going to ask somebody for a reader to read that for me, and what I would also like for y'all to look and see if you have footnotes that talk about Massa and Meribah. Okay, who's going to read for me Exodus chapter 17, 1-7? Come on, nice and loud, read it out. Okay, so does anybody have a footnote there? You have a footnote in your Bible about Manasseh or Massa and Meribah?
Numbers 20:11.
Okay, that's a reference. Does anybody actually have a definition? Testing and quarreling, or testing and rebellion, or the same thing that the Greek guy says. So this is what the Hebrew words actually mean. So when they were translating the Septuagint, they chose not to translate the names of the places, but they chose to translate what those names really mean. Because you remember, in Hebrew, names have a great deal of significance. And so that's why they called it Massa and Meribah here, because they tested the Lord. It was a place of testing, not that God was testing them, but that they tested God. They tested God's patience, and they quarreled with God or rebelled against God. The quarreling and rebellion is the same thing. And so when we get the writer to the Hebrews, he quotes that because that's what he's wanting to call attention to, because he's going to relate these two qualities not with the water and the rock. And I put in parentheses Numbers 28-13. That's the other place. That's about the water and the rock, when God tells Moses to speak to the rock and he strikes it, in case you want to do it. But we're not going to read that tonight, because we don't need that. So you see, the author of Hebrews is going to relate this to Numbers chapter 14. Okay, so I guess it's my turn to read. And I'm going to read for you Numbers chapter 14. It's a long chapter, but I'll try not to spend too much time. Well, I'm not going to read all of it. I may read the first 35 verses of it. Okay. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land?" Let me just stop here a minute. This is immediately following the sending out of the 12 spies into the promised land, and they come back, and 10 of them say, "Oh man, there's giants, we can't take them. Only Joshua and Caleb." Only Joshua and Caleb come back and say, "Hey, look, there's huge grapes over there, and the produce is great, and God's going to give us this land into our hand, and let's go get it." So only Joshua and Caleb have the right attitude. The other 10 say, "There's no way, we can't do it, they're too big, they'll kill us." And so, let me pick this back up. "And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" And so they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." So they're going to reject God's leadership through Moses, and they're going to say, "Okay, let's go back to Egypt." Okay? This is the rebellion. This is the rebellion. God has promised them this land, the Canaan land. He has promised them that they will enter into it. He has promised them that it is His gift to them. And they say, "We don't believe you, God." Not that we can't believe you, we refuse to believe you. We just do not believe, God, that you can protect us in this land. We do not believe that you can lead us into this land. We just don't believe you. And so we're going to elect a new leader. We're going to not only reject your land, we're going to reject your leader. We're going to elect a new leader, and we're going to go back to Egypt and be slaves. That's what they said. Okay. "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel, and Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, and those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation and the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe me despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence, and I will dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they.' But Moses said to the Lord, 'Then the Egyptians will hear of it, for by thy strength thou didst bring up the people out of the land of Egypt, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of the land, and they will have heard that thou, O Lord, art in the midst of the people, for thou, O Lord, art seen eye to eye while thy cloud stands over them, and thou dost go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now if thou dost slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of thy fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which He promised them by oath, therefore He slaughtered them in the wilderness.'" So you see Moses saying, "Don't do it, God. You're going to make yourself look like a fool in front of all these other nations." This is Moses' argument, right? But he'd do anything because, see, Moses, he loved these people and he did not want them to perish. Right? They were his people. And so he'd say anything to try to get God to go back on them. "But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as thou hast declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving in iniquity and transgression. But He will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this thy people, according to the greatness of thy loving kindness, just as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word, but indeed as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt in the wilderness and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers. Nor shall any of those who spurned me see it." So God's saying, okay, I'm going to forgive them, but they're not going to see the promised land. They rejected it, and they rejected me. They rebelled against me. They did not believe me. Even though I showed them all this evidence in the delivery so far, they wouldn't believe me. They wouldn't trust me. And so they don't get to see the promised land. They're done. They're going to wander out here in the desert for another 40 years, and they're going to die. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he has entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel that they are making against me. Say to them, 'As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses, your bodies shall fall dead in this wilderness. Even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you will not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness. And your sons shall be shepherds for 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years in the wilderness, and shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days, for every day you shall bear your guilt for a year, even for 40 years you shall know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do. Surely I will do all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they shall die." And so, the author of the book of Hebrews has this passage in mind, and I'm going to demonstrate that in just a little bit. And so, what he's saying to you in this second paranesis, in this second warning, what he's saying is, you better be careful. You better be careful, because if you reject God, you may not get a second chance. Now, he's not necessarily talking about eternal salvation here, but he's talking about the plan that God has for your life. If you reject what God has for your plan for your life, then you may not get a second chance. You may not get a second chance. These people didn't get a second chance. If you recall in the history, if you go back and look at Exodus and look at Numbers, they said, "Oh, well, maybe we messed up. Maybe, oh, let's go do it. Let's go take them." And they went and tried to enter Canaan, and they were beaten. The Lord said, "No, you're not going in. I said you're not. You rejected me. It's too late." And so one of the applications here, one of the things that the writer of Hebrews is trying to get off of these people is, do not back away. Do not rebel. Do not oppose the Lord, because if you do, it might be too late. It might be too late. You may not have a second chance. And so that's part of this paranesis. That's part of this warning here. So he's read the passage, and now he's going to develop the passage. We have verses 12 through 19. I'd like for Denise to read that for me, and I asked Denise in particular because I know that she has an NIV, and there's something in verse 12 that's going to be slightly different. It says essentially the same meaning, but it's going to be slightly different words from the other translations in the NIV. So I want you all to look at that. Look at your translations and see what she reads in verse 12 that is slightly different from what you have in verse 12. Denise. Okay, so read again for us just verse 12, and you guys are paying attention to what you have that's phrased just a little bit differently in your version from what the NIV has.
See to it, brothers, that none of you have a sinful, unbelieving heart.
Okay, that's enough. What does your version say?
Evil heart of unbelief.
Okay, but what about the beginning? Does it say see to it, or does it say watch out, or does it say
beware,
or watch out? Or look out, or be on guard. There are several different translations. Okay, so here's the thing. When somebody's translating, even from the Greek, you can't just do a word-for-word translation. You can't do that in any language. Those of you that are bilingual, those of you that know Spanish, for example, you know that you can't do a word-for-word translation of Spanish into English, it won't make any sense. The idioms don't track. In Spanish, you're going to use definite articles with a lot of things that you don't use in English, etc. And it's the same thing in Greek. And so what we get here, we get to this word in the NIV says, see to it then. Well, that actually technically is a more technically accurate translation than watch out or beware, but it doesn't capture the urgency. The urgency of watch out or beware is why the other translators have elected to use a different word, even though the word is see to it. Now, I had a reason for wanting you to see the see to it, and this is kind of a little technical goodie, but you might find it interesting. You see two words in verse 12 that are also repeated in verse 19. And one of them is see. What's the other one?
Unbelief.
Unbelief. And so you see those two words in chapter 12, chapter 3, verse 12, and you see those two words in chapter 19. This is a rhetoric device that's called inclusio. When he puts these at the beginning and these at the end, he's saying this is all one unit. This is one thought here. And I've marked that thought at the beginning and the end with the same pair of words. Okay? And those words are see and unbelief. We have the see to it in verse 12, and in verse 19 we have, so we see then that this happened because of unbelief. Alright, so now we know that this is one little unit. Alright, so what does he say, and what is the warning number one, and what is the encouragement number two that he says that he has here between verses 12 and 19?
Warning against unbelief.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's one of our key words. It's in the inclusio, right? What else? Okay, that's the encouragement. Okay? So we have the warning number one, and part of the warning is what? Don't fall away, right? Don't fall away because of your evil heart or because of your unbelief. And there's even kind of a play on words there, because we have the same, what word are we familiar with in English that means to fall away? What? What'd you say? Yeah, what else? What else? That's not the one I'm looking for. How about apostasy? You know apostasy, right? Okay, so what's the Greek word for unbelief? What's the Greek word for faith? Let me do this. Let me get blue. Alright, so the Greek word for faith, now this is actually the verb form, I believe, pistuo, okay? This is P, iota, sigma, tau, epsilon, omega. Pistuo is I believe, okay? So, the Greeks, to negate something, frequently would just put the letter A in front of it. We have the same thing. You have tonal music, you have atonal music, right? You have a theist, you have an atheist, right? So you put the word A in front of it and it negates it. Or the alpha, okay? And so what we have here is unbelief is apistis, and falling away is apostas. Okay? So he says, because of your epistis, don't let your epistis lead you into apostasy. So it's kind of a play on words in Greek here. Do not let your lack of faith or your unbelief lead you into a falling away. So that's the main warning. Because what happened to the Hebrews in the wilderness? They let their unbelief lead them into a falling away, into a rebellion. So that's the warning. Now, what's one of the ways that you cannot let that happen? And that's the encouragement. Somebody, you said it. What's the encouragement? Encourage each other daily. To build one another up. To meet together, just like we're doing tonight. To meet with people of like minds and to say, brother, I'm with you. Brother, let us praise God together. Let us join together in our faith. Let's make a community of faith. Let's meet with each other. Let us be brothers and sisters in Christ. And that's the encouragement. Because that's one of the ways that you can battle this. You know, if you hang out by yourself and you don't join with other believers, you know, those doubts can come more and more frequently. You can start to say, you know, I read this stuff once and I believed it back then, but you know, this is kind of weird, all this stuff. And what does it really have to do with my life today? What does it have to do with, you know, with what's going on? What, do I really need this stuff? And you can sort of begin to doubt. Even the strongest of you will sometimes have doubts. Even the strongest of you will say, "Is this really true?" I mean, we'll do it. Sometimes, if James will let me, I'll do a lesson on doubt. All right, but even the strongest of us will have some doubt. But you know what? It gets a lot harder to doubt if you're hanging out, if you're rubbing shoulders with your fellow believers, and they're saying, "Oh yeah, we believe in this. Oh yeah, this is the way it is," and they take for granted that you're a believer, and you take for granted that they're a believer, and you encourage each other and you build each other up in the faith. Now, Paul exhorts you to do the same thing, to build up one another in the faith. Well, that's what the writer of Hebrews says here. He says, number one, be careful. Be careful lest your unbelief make you fall away. And number two, one of the ways that you do that is by encouraging each other. Okay? And then, to wrap this up, I'm going to just... Somebody have their finger in Numbers 14. We are going to relate... I'm just going to demonstrate that it was this episode at Kadesh Barnea that the author of Hebrews was referring to. That's why he quoted the Septuagint instead of the Masoretic text. And we're going to demonstrate that because of another rhetorical device that he uses here in verses 16, 17, and 18. And what he does is he asks a question, and then he answers the question with the answer being in question form itself. Okay, so in verse 16, he says, "For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses..." Okay, this is verse 16. Somebody read for me Numbers chapter 14, verse 22.
"Now one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous sign I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times.
Is that verse 22? Okay, somebody have a different translation? My Numbers 14, chapter 22, chapter 14, verse 22 says, "Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, have yet put me to the test." Okay? All the people. So in verse 16 of Hebrews 3, he says, "For who has provoked him? Indeed, not all of those who come out of Egypt." And Numbers 14:22 says, "All." All right. Chapter 7, or verse 17, it says, "And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness?" Somebody read for me Numbers 14:32. "For you, your bodies will fall in the wilderness." See, this he tells you right here in these verses that. Or he indicates that he's thinking back to Numbers chapter 14 here. One more. In verse 18 he says, "And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest but to those who were disobedient?" So now again it's verse 22, but continuing on to verse 23. So Numbers 14, 22 and 23. Okay, so in this passage he says, "They will not enter into his rest," and so the writer of Hebrews says it's the ones who were disobedient, and Numbers it says the ones who put me to the test, which is the same thing, right? They were disobedient, they put God to the test by being disobedient, by not believing God when He said that they would come into the promised land. And so we have here now the paranesis kind of continues in chapter 4 with the believer's rest. We don't have time to do that tonight. We'll do that next week. But I will stop short. I'm going to go through verse 13 of chapter 4, because verse 14 begins with the high priest thing, and that's going to back into the superiority of Christ. I'm going to let James have the stuff that's back to the superiority of Christ. So just in summary, what we have here in the Paranetic session is we have a recap of Psalm 95, but from the Septuagint, because it's recalling the episode at Kadesh Barnea where when the spies came back, the people said, we can't do this. So their unbelief caused them to fall away. Their apistia caused their apostakalein, okay, and it caused them to fall away, and they didn't get a second chance. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying to these people who are contemplating, you know, maybe we ought to chuck all this and just go back to Judaism. He's saying, no, you can't do that. You cannot do that. Do not allow unbelief to allow you to or to encourage you to fall away. And this is his encouragement here. And he compares it after he exegetes the Psalm 94 in dealing with Numbers chapter 14. And that's all I have.